Let's take off our clothes and fool around. That's the opening line of the last poem in Ellen Bass's 2014 book, Like a Beggar, that celebrates life and death and everything in between, exploring what it means to be human. Famous for her poetry workshops and earlier for her healing through writing initiatives, Ellen Bass talked about blossoming as a poet in this century in part one of our conversation recorded in 2017, the year she was appointed a Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. In part two, we'll hear about her early literary mentors, the late poet Anne Sexton, and the feminist press founder, Florence Howe. Ellen Bass also talks about what she dubs as her omnivorous sexuality, today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and here's Ellen Bass with the title poem from her 2007 book.
The Human Line. After I had carried her those 9 months, those 284 days, each with its sheaf of hours, each hour fanned out into minutes, into seconds, as though time had been sliced thin as onion skin. After I'd hauled this cache of cells as it swept through a kind of rough evolution, devising arm buds and sex buds and the buds for 20 milk teeth, and then birthed her, my cervix cranked open a rusty hinge, and the pain, what a tree might feel when lightning splits it and the two halves fall away. Then I realized, I'm not proud to admit this is what it took, that everyone was lugged in the sack of a woman's body, a woman stretched past reason or slit with a steel scalpel. Even if she left that baby right there, without counting the pearly toes, thumbing the miniature knuckles, even if she didn't look into the face, neutral as Buddha, before thirst even, if she was drugged or relieved and the baby whisked away, still she gave this child every intricate bone of both feet, the hollow vertebrae, tiny liver, lungs that fill with air for the first time and begin without a lesson, bringing this world in and releasing it. Did Mary feel like this when the angel came to her, holding his useless lily? Not in the surfeit of gilt frames where she's poised, serene, but those few where the artist knew, had seen women already crushed, bowed. I was standing in the long hospital corridor when the knowledge entered me. I didn't want it. It was grief, extending back through time and reaching into the future. All these babies, all these mothers with their hearts beating outside their bodies. And now I was one of them. Lashed to the Human Line.
The Human Line, that's the title poem of the book by Ellen Bass from Copper Canyon Press. And I've read a lot of wonderful poems about pregnancy and childbirth, but I love the way that you put it in context of just humankind there. I find that very powerful. You have had such an interesting life because, I mean, you're a lesbian. But you have been married to a man, mm-hmm. and you have had children.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk some about you becoming a lesbian. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that's too personal.
I could say a couple of things.
Sure.
I could say a couple of things that I think are worth saying.
Because you were interested in boys when you were young.
I was boy crazy. I loved boys. In my family, we joke because I had so many boyfriends that my children can't keep them straight. And there's a refrain we always use, you know, she loved them all. I did. I just loved them all. And I loved sex with men. I think that what happened for me is a couple of things. One is I was in a very bad marriage. And the other is that as women started writing in this second wave of feminism, I became so deeply fascinated and compelled by what I was reading. Susan Griffin writing Woman in Nature, Adrian Rich's poetry, Audre Lorde, Mary Daly. I felt like I had read what men had to say for 30 years and that all I wanted to do was hear what women had to say. And so I, unlike most people I know, really became a lesbian through literature.
Wow.
And I wanted to be around women. I started teaching women's writing groups. I wanted to hear what had not been put to paper, what was being put to paper for the first time. I mean, all of these amazing writers. And I just was tired of men. I felt like I had spent a lot of time in that world, and this world of what women were discovering was of utmost fascination to me. And I thought, well, if I get divorced, then I'm just going to be with women. And I had had very minimal romantic and sexual experience with women. And so I just took it on faith that the sexual part would work out. My daughter has this great word. She calls it the bits. She says people's bits don't really matter that much. And I just thought it would be fine. And it was. It was different. It was great. It wasn't like the stories that you hear from most people where it wasn't quite right. You know, sexually with men, you know, they liked men, but they didn't feel passionate about men. And then they found women, and it's like, oh, that's really where my passion is. And what I think I am is genuinely bisexual. I really think that gender is not the thing. And I hope that my wife and I live into a long old age and die at the same moment. But I think that if I were not with her, I don't know if I'd be with a man or with a woman. I think it's really the person.
The person.
At this point in my life, I'm no longer tired of men. After all these years with women and living so much with women, I'm again interested, very interested in men. Not romantically, because I'm married and that's my focus romantically and sexually, but in terms of just the excitement and wonder of getting to know people intimately, some of my very closest friends are men. And I love now, again, knowing what men think and feel and what's going on with them. But I had to come around to that. It took some time away. The main reason I want to talk about it is I think in our world today, with so much gender and sexual orientation upheaval, that it's not unusual. I think of myself as omnivorous.
I like that.
Good.
But it's good. Interesting. You found that part of your life through literature.
Yes.
I love that.
Yes. I'm probably not the only person, but that really is what happened for me.
Yeah. There's a short poem in here that is called The Moment I Knew I Shouldn't Have Married My Husband. This had subsection 4 of this, and I thought it might be kind of nice to have that juxtaposed.
Yes. The moment I knew I shouldn't have married my husband. We were at a dark, deserted rest stop, somewhere between Minnesota and Santa Cruz, on the way home from our honeymoon. I guess we'd been fighting. Our fights could have been a measure of infinity, like grains of sand or stars. What I remember is the short walk back from the bathroom along the concrete path, lined with scruffy, unkillable bushes, and the sudden clarity, I'd made a mistake. But what, I asked that voice that wouldn't defend itself, what about the new orange towels we just bought? I'm not kidding. This is exactly what I said to myself. Even though now I can't stand that color. Even though now there's nothing orange in my house, not even a goldfish.
The Moment I Knew I Shouldn't Have Married My Husband, from The Human Line, by Ellen Bass, who's with me today here on New Letters on the Air.
That is so human. Oh, my God.
It's horrible. That's like somebody saying, realizing they're making a mistake, but I've already sent out all the invitations, you know? Well, good thing you had the orange and white shoes to balance off the color orange.
Yeah.
Because you have that great poem. That's really fun.
I could read that one if you want.
Okay. That's a new one, isn't it?
That's a new one. It's not in any of the books yet, but it was published in The New Yorker, and I have it here.
That would be fun. Now, you're working on a new book, too, right?
I am. I'm working on a new book.
Will this be part of it, do you think?
Oh, yeah. Everything goes in that's keepable.
It is nice that your books are true collections. They're not all about one thing. I mean,
no.
I do like books like that, too, but it really is a nice collection of things that have to do with loss and love and just a variety of life experiences, I think.
Yes,
which is
nice. I feel the same way. I admire books that really have a theme, that have their own kind of storyline in a way, or arc. And I'd sort of love to be able to do that, to know, I'm writing on this theme. Because with me, every poem is just starting absolutely from scratch.
Yeah. Well, you do have themes within sections of the book, because
yes.
I really felt
that mother's
the human
death,
line, so. Section one definitely
yes,
deals so
very
much with
much
that.
So. Yeah. Yeah.
So you have the best of both worlds.
Well, thank you.
There
That's
you
a
go.
Nice way to put
yeah.
it. Well, since we're on orange, this is a much better orange. This is called The Orange and White High-Heeled Shoes. Today, I'm thinking about those shoes. White with a tangerine stripe across the toe and forceful orange heels that fit both my mother and me. We used to shop like that, trying them on side by side. That was when there still was a man who would cradle your heel in his palm and guide your foot. Sometimes he would think he made a sale, only to have one of us turn to the other, and he would have to kneel again, hoping to ease another naked soul into the bed of suede or leather. I thought those shoes were just the peak of chic. And, my God, you bought me a pair of orange cotton gloves to complete the ensemble. Why is there such keen pleasure in remembering? You are dead 10 years, and these showy slippers, we wore them more than half a century ago. The first boy had not yet misted my breasts with his breath, and you were strong as a muscled goddess, gliding nylons over your calves, lifting your amplitude into a breastplate. Who will remember these pumpkin-colored pumps when I die too? Who will remember how we slid into them, like girls diving into a cedar-tinged lake? Like bees entering the trumpet of a flower, like birds disappearing into the green, green leaves of summer.
That was in The New Yorker, and it was called The Orange and White High-Heeled Shoes.
Yes.
With Ellen Bass. And we have to say that you were taught by Anne Sexton.
I was. I did what was then called a Master's of Arts in creative writing, what would be the equivalent today of the MFA at Boston University, and Anne Sexton was teaching there. That was in 1969-1970. And so I had the extraordinary good fortune to study with her in a small seminar. And I think I can owe my sticking to poetry to her, because the other teachers that I had in that program really didn't understand or have any insight into what I was trying to do. And I was not very good. In fact, I was pretty bad. But she could see the potential in it. And I think the others were men. This is back a lot of years. And the idea of a young woman's authentic, honest, straightforward voice was still very new. And the advice that I would get from the other teachers was just cut this out and cut that out. And so I would take a not very good poem and make a much smaller, not very good poem.
they didn't tell you how to replace it with something good.
Yeah. They didn't tell me, okay, you need to go deeper here, or you need to work your language harder here, or this is rambling, but I can see that there's something underneath here. Can you try and find language to make this richer and distill it? I mean, I wasn't getting any real instruction. And when I got to Anne, she said, oh, no, you should be writing more. You should be writing longer lines. You should be stretching out. And so even though I had a long way to go and I wasn't writing great or even very good poems with her, I was freed up to explore what was possible and encouraged and essentially given the message that, yes, you might be at the very beginning here, but keep on going and don't restrict yourself. And that was just amazing. And she was a fabulous teacher. Her public persona, as many people know, was very dramatic. And of course, she did suffer from mental illness. But when she was in the classroom, she wasn't at all paying attention to herself. She wasn't flamboyant. She wasn't narcissistic. None of these things. She was thoughtful, respectful, really well balanced, all about the students. And I don't know what was in her mind, but I have my own story that I tell myself that at least matches what I saw, is that it was a kind of special space for her where she could let go of all of her demons and everything that was so hard and focus on the students. And she did talk about that period of teaching as being very satisfying to her, and she was good at it. And we saw, I think, a different Anne Sexton as her students than most people had a chance to see.
When you hear a story like that, you think you know why Maxine Cuman, you know, they were such dear friends.
Yes. And yes,
that was probably the part of her, too,
yes,
that she loved and,
yes,
and couldn't bear when she took her own life.
Yes.
So, to think of being taught by Anne Sexton and making that a beginning, and that you had all these men professors, is that the impetus for that first anthology that you worked on with women poets? Because wasn't that the first anthology dedicated to women poets
in
America?
It was. The first major anthology, No More Masks.
No More Masks, an anthology of poems,
yes,
by women.
And it didn't really come out of that experience. That came out of an experience with my other early great mentor, Florence Howe, with whom I co-edited the anthology. And Florence is somebody who is known very much in academic circles, but not so much outside. She is co-founder of the Feminist Press, which is the oldest running women's press in the world. Also, Florence knew every woman writer and brought some of them back out of obscurity. One of the early missions of the press was to re-find works that were classic works that had gone out of print that were going to be lost to us and to publish them again. So Tilly Olson, Grace Paley, The Yellow Wallpaper, Charlotte Perkins Gilman. I mean, they did amazing work and continued to do amazing work. In the last, I guess, decade or so, they've published these monumental volumes of women writing Africa, women writing Asia, going with scholars from all over the continent of Africa and all over India, finding works that had never been translated into English, and some of them that had never been even published. So just bringing women's literature, making it available and making it permanently in the covers of books so that it won't get lost again has been a huge thing. And Florence really, I would say if you're going to name one person who is why we have the whole discipline of women's studies in colleges and universities across the world, it's Florence. But most people don't know that.
Wow.
Yes. And she was my teacher at Goucher College.
And that's where you went for
that's
undergraduate
where I went for
school.
Undergraduate.
Oh, so that preceded
that
your
preceded
time with Anne Sexton.
It did. Florence was my first mentor. And we went on to have close association. She had this pilot project in which Goucher students taught poetry to vocational students in high school. I was teaching auto mechanics. All the things that I learned from her when we were teaching those students are the same things that I have used and adapted through my entire 50 years of teaching writing, of this deep respect for the student, this open dialogue, a quality of paying attention and listening rather than thinking that you know everything, and a collaborative approach that is really just so basic but was revolutionary at the time. So Florence, shortly after I graduated college, I was at BU studying with Anne, and that semester was coming to a close, and she came to visit me. I was living in Cambridge. And she thought that I was depressed. And I really wasn't depressed. I mean, things weren't going perfectly. I had a boyfriend that wasn't really the best boyfriend for me. And, you know, maybe I was not ecstatic, but I wasn't depressed. But Florence thought that I was. And she had recently lost someone to depression. And so Florence's cure for anything is work. And she told me this many years later that she decided she had to cook up a project for us because if I was depressed, I needed to work. And so she suggested that we do this anthology together. And at first, we couldn't even conceive of an anthology of poems solely by women. We thought we would collect poems about women by both men and women. And so that's how we started out.
Oh.
And after a few months, it became clear that the plethora of poems was overwhelming. And also, we had no time frame. It was going to be, you know, from the Greeks forward. And so it became clear, oh, no, we have to narrow this down. And that's how we wound up having an anthology of poems by women. We said, okay, it will just be 20th century. It will just be American. We made one exception for Margaret Atwood. And it will just be poems by women. And that's how the anthology got framed. And we worked on that for several delicious years together. And I was just a pig in mud because, you know, I was just a kid. And her sense of respect and democratic ways of doing things, she allowed me to not just kind of be her gopher or subordinate, but really allowed me in on all the decision making and took me on as a full co-editor.
Wow, what a great experience and what a wonderful thing for a poet to do all that reading of
yes.
other poets.
Oh my God, that came out in 1973. So at that time, I read, because it was possible to read, every single poem that was published in a book by a woman in America.
Wow.
And some that weren't published. And, of course, no one could do that today. So I had a deep reading history.
Somebody that I'm sure you must have included in that anthology, and she's been on my mind since we'd celebrated the 100th anniversary of her birth, was Gwendolyn Brooks.
Yes.
And there's a poem in here that's not about Gwendolyn, but about your mother. I thought I might get you to read this.
Yes, this was inspired by the Golden Shovel poems.
Oh, okay.
This wonderful anthology. And the idea is to take a line, in this case, from Gwendolyn Brooks, and that is the end word of each line of your own poem. The poem was a little wonky, and so I switched some of the lines around. So in the anthology, it's called A Twisted Shovel because it's not a perfect golden shovel, but this poem is called Morning. The morning of her death, she woke fierce. Some dormant force revived, insistent. For the last time, I sat my mother up, shifted the loose mass of her body to lean against me. Her dried-up legs dangled next to mine, triumphs of will. All the morning she forced herself to spritz cheap perfume, hoist each pendulous breast into its halter, place the straps in the old ruts. We were alone, petals falling from bouquets crowded around us. I pulled some pillows behind me when I couldn't hold her any longer, and we rested there. The body of my mother slumped against my breast, the slow droop of green stalks in their vases. Her long exhaled breaths kept coming against her resolve, and in the exquisite pauses in between, I could feel her settle, the way an infant grows heavier and heavier in your arms as it falls asleep.
That was Morning After Gwendolyn Brooks by Ellen Bass from her book Like a Beggar. This is New Letters on the Air. This has been a lot of fun, but we've got to have one love poem. You have so many great poems that are dedicated to your wife now. Do you have one that you'd like to read?
I could read Ode to Repetition.
Well, I like Ode to Repetition because that's where the title, Like a Beggar, comes from.
Yes. I think Annie Dillard said that everyone loves the same things best. And so a writer needs to look for what he or she loves only, you know, that other people don't love. And I'm sure that I'm not the only person in the world who loves repetition, but it's not like the most popular thing to love, you know, especially in our culture. Everyone wants new and different and
Something fresh.
Yes. And I have a reputation in my family and among my close friends for being, you know, exceedingly attached to repetition. So I thought, oh, I need to write an ode to repetition. Ode to Repetition. I like to take the same walk down the wide expanse of Woodrow to the ocean, and most days I turn left toward the lighthouse. The sea is always different, some days dreamy, waves hardly waves, just a broad undulation in no hurry to arrive. Other days the surf's drunk, crashing into the cliffs like a car wreck. And when I get home, I like the same dishes stacked in the same cupboards, and then unstacked, and then stacked again. And the rhododendron, spring after spring, blossoming its pink ceremony. I could dwell in the kingdom of Coltrane, those rivers of breath through his horn, as he forms each phrase of lush life over and over until I die. Once I was afraid of this, opening the curtains every morning, only to close them again each night. You could despair in the fixed town of your own life. But when I wake up to pee, I'm grateful the toilet's in its usual place, the sink with its gift of water. I look out at the street, the halos of lampposts in the fog, or the moon rinsing the parked cars. When I get back in bed, I find the woman who's been sleeping there each night for 30 years. Only she's not the same. Her body more naked in its aging, its disorder, though I still come to her like a beggar. One morning, one of us will rise bewildered without the other and open the curtains. There will be the same shaggy redwood in the neighbor's yard, and the faultless stars going out one by one into the day.
Ode to Repetition, the poem that contains the title of Ellen Bass's 2014 book, Like a Beggar, one of many odes in that collection. You can hear more from this and her earlier book, The Human Line, in the other half of our 2017 conversation on our website, newletters.org, or find links on Facebook and Twitter at New Letters Radio. From New Letters Magazine at UMKC, today's show was produced with Danny Reeves, Timothy Larrison, Marissa Reddick, Cedric Hurt, Dylan Cramhorn, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.